Welcome to SLA, where you can learn to avoid gaslighting yourself and your language teaching practices,
break down academic gatekeeping on second language acquisition,
and girl boss your way through dynamic, engaging, and research-based language teaching.
I'm Ben Fisher Rodriguez, and my pronouns are he, him.
I'm Bill Langley, and my pronouns are he, him.
I'm Brian Smith, and my pronouns are he, they.
Let's slay. Welcome back to another episode of Slay, SLA, Second Language Acquisition for Everyone. And this is actually going to be our last episode of the year while we take a little bit of a holiday break. So we really hope that you will be able to take some time to recharge that we know is very necessary at this time of year. We will come back with our next episode in January 2025. So be looking forward to that. And Bill, I understand there's something you wanted to mention.
Yeah. So in one of our previous episodes, we talked about language play, and I got a nice little message from Diane Neubauer, and she had some clarifying words about what exactly is language play. So she wanted to just kind of help us understand that it's specifically when you're using language to create something for entertainment purposes or an enjoyable experience. So like story asking, picture talk, those are things that like help students use their imagination and play around with the language, asking for words that they wouldn't usually ask for, maybe using structures that they wouldn't usually use, or for purposes of like on the comprehension side, like watching movies and understanding them. That could be Do you think it, like that would then like fit into like the world of language play then, if it's using that like to construct enter like a positive experience in your brain through language?
As in contrast to playing with language as an abstract concept, so you know, putting on a Kahoot and being like, what does this word mean? It's like, yes, they are playing with communicative exchange or imagination going on. It's, you know, just matching meanings to forms and stuff, which, you know,
All right.
And really just, you've still got to have some purpose that requires language to meet that purpose, right? Like you can play a Kahoot about anything, but you can't like tell a story without using language. So anyway, this week's episode, we will be talking about checking for understanding and the different ways that you can go about doing that, ways that might be more effective, less effective, our experiences with that. So just starting out with the gaslighting section, where we'll be talking a little bit about maybe some strategies we've used that have not slayed, as you know, and then maybe what we've learned from them. So when we say checking for understanding, basically that means asking your students questions to see if they know what you're talking about. That's really important for language class, for any classes, but especially for language classes where students are experiencing new language and, you know, you've really just got to keep your finger on the pulse of like whether they are understanding you as you're giving them input in the language. It's really important. So some methods of checking for understanding might involve asking students to raise hands. You could have students write their answers somewhere. You could even use some kind of electronic device to collect their responses. There's lots of different things you can do. But in terms of some strategies that have not necessarily panned out the way that we wanted, or maybe we've learned a bit about why other methods are more effective, is there something that jumps to the front of your mind when you think about that?
I'm thinking about just like the basic, like just asking, like, do you understand? And then either someone like the one sympathetic child friend in your class who, you know, nods along to everything, goes, yes. And then you go, wonderful. And then you move on. That is just asking, do you understand? Understanding is such a continuum of understanding. Like, do you understand the words? Do you understand the sense? Do you understand what's going on generally in the class? Do you understand that we're at school? You know, like what the context of what's happening? That's what our article for today calls a loaded assumption, is that somebody's going to answer and then it'll just kind of, I don't know, that does anything. It doesn't really do anything because kids are not exactly jumping to reveal when they don't know something. And I think that's a basic human impulse, is essentially to protect your pride in some ways by being like, yep, I got it all the time and it's fine. I've seen this with adults as well as kids, just, you know, the not understanding, but just silently absorbing that and just moving on in the hopes of not sticking out. So we need to use techniques that are a little bit more consequential and a little bit more illustrative if we want to actually understand what our learners are understanding, to what degree, and who in the classroom, because sometimes it can be variable from student to student.
Yeah, I think kids are really, really, really good at pretending they understand. They're really good at pretending that they understand and playing school. And like sometimes in other classes, that's okay. They can just go back and reread a textbook chapter or review notes to see what they missed. But that's a little bit harder in language class where it's in the moment. You need that interaction piece so that I can understand what you understand and I can help you fix what you don't understand. And even if a student goes home and reads the story that we read in class, like, yeah, they're getting the input that maybe they missed, but they're still not getting the interaction.
And, yeah. And I mean, our learners are novices in ways that they are not in other classes. Like, they might be learning new content in history, but they've studied history before. They've studied math before. A lot of times, this is the first time they're learning a new language. So they are not used to gaps in understanding that might exist. And especially adolescents, they're still building their self-image and socially constructing themselves. And so they really don't want to be embarrassed and have anyone think that they don't know what's going on. So they do almost anything to hide their lack of understanding. So it's our job to both make our classrooms a safe place where it's okay to say that they don't know or ask for help, but also make sure that we are actually using formative assessment as a way to check in on what everyone is able to grasp. So I guess when I think about a slightly less effective strategy, or maybe very much less effective strategy for checking for understanding, it would be when I first started teaching and I would just ask for volunteers for every question. I'd ask the question and put my hand up in the air and just wait for that one kid who just absolutely loves languages or just super, super motivated and really a faster processor than everyone else to answer the question. And I'm like, well, one kid got it. So that means that I did a good job as teaching. Actually, that is not a representative sample. I mean, of the entire class's understanding, it's just that one kid. And so, I mean, I would say that it's not like I never ask for volunteers, but I do it very, very rarely these days because I've understood that, you know, it's just not really that helpful to me as their teacher to be able to shift my instruction based on whether they're getting it or not.
First, before I make another comment on pitfalls and checking for understanding, I do want to highlight something that you said, Brian, about kids not having taken language class before, so they don't know what they're supposed to do in class yet. I think I've thought that before, but you had better words. So now I'm like understanding that a little bit more. I've got a different perspective. So thanks for that. I think that a pitfall that I've seen and or heard of before is using popsicle sticks to call on students or whatever name randomizer and not adapting the question for the student that gets called. If you ask the question so everyone hears it and then you pull a stick or spin a wheel or whatever, and that person has to answer. But that doesn't ensure that that is an appropriate question for that student. I've got a wide variety of levels in my class. So if I ask an open-ended question, then call on a student that might really need the support of an either-or question, then I'm just setting them up in front of the entire class. Couple different ways I go about it. Like if maybe I do ask the question and then pick someone, then I need to make sure that I'm reassuring them that whatever their answer is, however well they can answer, is as well as they can answer. So like, I'll accept that and I will support that and help lift you up. But my preferred method is to pull the stick first, then ask the question so everyone hears it, then call on the student. So I see who I'm going to be asking. I adapt the question for them and then ask the question to everyone because they don't know if they're getting called on or not. So then I've set them up for success in front of everyone, and everyone still had to pay attention to the question.
I've heard that if you call on the student before asking the question, that just gives everyone else an opportunity to shut off and not listen, because they know that they're not having to answer. And so that's why I don't do that. But it's really interesting when you say that you have in mind who you're going to call in before you kind of reveal it, even though you're still, I guess, are you physically using popsicle sticks? I haven't seen those in few years, but teachers in my school use some kind of randomized wheel picker or something like that.
I have a mix. If I want to do like a public call on someone, like if we've got time to play Gimkit or Blookit or something, I'll do a public wheel to show, and then that kid gets to pick the game that we play, something like that. So I use Flippity to make those. But if it's just questions in class discussion to encourage participation, then I use a set of numbered sticks. The numbers correspond with the number of the pocket that their phone goes in, and it's also like alphabetical order and whatnot. So I use that, so then I just have the one set of sticks.
That is like in the neighborhood of Anne-Marie Chase's magic cards that she uses for formative assessment as well, which is just having kids write their names on index cards and then recording the quality of their responses on the index card as a way to take data. And also helps with the randomization bit, right? You can pull a card, look at who it is, pitch the question at an appropriate level so that everyone has to think. The Teach Like a Champion universe calls that ratio because it increases the ratio of students who are thinking actively instead of tuning out, like you said. And then, you know, pose the question to the kid, kind of record the quality of their response. So, Joe, because I find it a little bit easier for me to just carry my little iPad around, even if that does make my kids call me a sticky iPad baby to my big bald head. But I use that because for me, it's just easier to manage that technology. But yeah, the randomization helps totally. And that also, another way, you know, if you have the wheel in front of everybody, they're going to see who's going to get called on ahead of time and might tune out. I like the either the sticks or the magic cards or the class dojo, just because it's my little secret until I reveal it. So that, you know, increases the tension of thinking ahead of time.
And I guess too, as well, for me personally, it's kind of like, I do expect all of my students to be able to answer any level of question that I ask. So I'm not going to like think in advance, oh, Johnny needs a simpler question, because I kind of feel like students might start to feel not called out, but like they might notice that kind of trend that you're always asking simpler questions to certain students. And if Johnny doesn't know how to answer my question, it's my job to help him do it, like not just allow him to continue to not be able to answer it, if that makes sense. I don't know. So that's just something I need to think about more.
That's a perspective that I need to add into my thinking on that too. So
yeah, giving them softball questions and then also giving them the next level up of question that they are just barely hanging on, but they get through, and then, you know, giving them more of those until they're at that level, right? And then that's, I think, but you only know that if you're asking lots of questions.
I guess you could like go with, if you do start with maybe a softball question and they get it, then you could level up right then and there. Or if you overestimated and the question is too complex, like just reword it.
See that
blank look on their face.
Yeah, gear shift down, you know, back down to an either or question if you started it open-ended, from an either or to a yes or no, that sort of thing. Yeah, I think, but that also makes me think of something else. And like I said, you ultimately only know this if you're asking lots of questions to your students all the time and have a really good feel for where the general class level is, but then also for, you know, individual students as you kind of start to see their language proficiency emerge in class over time and across the different things that you've done and context and that sort of thing. So I think that we kind of were talking in preparation about this of sometimes you worry about students getting bored, or you feel like you've already asked so many questions that it's bogging down the pace. So you just get into like head down bold charging mode with the content, whatever the content is, you know, a story, content-based instruction, whatever it is, and you just kind of start powering through, and then you stop checking for understanding because you're worried it's making things boring. But I think that the checks for understanding can actually add momentum because it just builds in natural repetitions for everybody to kind of solidify new content learning anyways, as well as giving more exposure to the language structures that students are acquiring and that sort of thing. So I think, you know, getting over that fear of doing too much and that's getting so boring. It's like, also, it's fine if you're not entertaining 100% of the time.
Yeah. And I just think too, like for me, that's why it's so important to focus on community building in the beginning and making sure that everyone understands like that we're a respectful classroom community and like we aren't going to make fun of anyone for not knowing something or saying something wrong. And so I really think that although I do use cold calling a lot, my students generally are not put off by it or embarrassed because they know that I will support them if they can answer it and it's okay to make mistakes. So yeah. Okay. Any other thoughts on that?
I think it boils down to preparation too. I've been thinking about this based on what Bill was talking about having question ready for a student at their level. Sometimes we'll get to the end of a lesson and ask students to do something with the information, but we haven't been checking the understanding along the way. And that's where we kind of find out that everything fell apart. One of my previous pitfalls was knowing that we were going into content and doing some content with students, but not planning the questions. It's okay to plan the questions. So it's okay to plan your questions ahead of time. Totally.
Sweet.
All right. Before we gatekeep, let's take a quick break.
Today, what we're ungatekeeping is actually not kept in the traditional sense. It is freely available out on ye old internet. So we encourage you to go check it out. I'm subscribed to an email list that is called Evidence Snacks by an education writer and teacher trainer named Peps McCray. In it, he distills evidence-based education research into essentially 5-minute little articles about one specific topic. And what does the evidence say helps us be the most responsive, best teachers out there? These little evidence snacks are very snack-like. They're truly 5-minute read or less. But he also links to research papers that are relevant. I think actually one of the research papers that we did for observations came from Evidence Snacks, actually. He links to research articles and further reads if you want to go deeper into the topic at hand or into other topics that have articles related to them. And it's just overall a great resource for teaching, with again the caveat that when you're reading general education research, content area instruction is necessarily different from language instruction that we do. So take with grains of salt in the principles that you know of language acquisition and what you know about language teaching and learning before you, you know, read any of these things and just be like, oh, he says I have to do this, and then immediately adapt to your world language class. So we read an article and it was so short and it was about checking for understanding. In the article, it talks about how responsive teaching, which is the sort of teaching that gets us the best results with students, is being able to make course corrections based on student understanding. So if they get it and they're good and they've processed the information, then you're able to move on and teach them more. If they haven't got it, that you're able to double back and make adjustments such that they understand. In order to make these course corrections or confirmations that you're on the right course, you need to be checking for understanding along the way. And so these comprehension checks need to be, he lists out for them being valid so that you're actually getting a complete picture of your student's understanding. And they need to be efficient because if you had to ask each individual child the extent of their understanding, that would take forever. So he talks about different ways in which teachers have done this in the past and kind of what he thinks to be the most valid, most efficient. He starts with what I alluded to earlier, the loaded assumption, the do you understand? That obviously will not necessarily give you a valid answer because you will have the understanding of maybe one brave soul who says, yep, I get it. And it is efficient because, you know, everyone wants to get it over with quickly and you're all dying inside, but it doesn't necessarily get you the information that you need to make a good informed decision in your teaching. My thinking, and I don't know if what Bill and Brian think of this, is that doing the things like fist to five for comprehension sometimes is a little bit more has a bit more of an illustrative effect than just asking if you understand. Again, students don't want to let on that they're not understanding, but if you have students with most students are doing fours and fives, like, okay, you're probably on a pretty good track. Maybe keep an eye on the kids on fours or threes. area, that's when they're starting to try to telegraph that, like, they're holding for you to double back, revisit information, do more comprehension checks, cold calling, whatever it is that we lay out here. Do you understand on its own? Not great. Maybe trying fist to five sort of stuff is a little bit better, but that goes into another category of response.
I like fist to five also for, like, asking at the end of class how my speed was, or maybe 0 to 10 fingers about how much of class did you understand, 0 being none, 10 being everything, or even just like thumbs up, thumbs down. I do ask students to close their eyes or make sure it doesn't look like they're watching other people, because, like, you don't want anyone feeling uncomfortable. But
what's funny, these adaptations we're talking about actually move into the thing that Peps McRae describes as more efficient and valid anyways, which is whole class questioning. But we'll get there. So a load of the assumption is just asking the whole class, do you understand? Not great. The things that Bill described that I was describing, maybe a little bit better. The next one he describes is skewed sampling, which can also be very efficient, but is just taking hands. So if a student, you know, raises their hand, is like, I'm going to answer the question. You're getting a student who is confident. And so they may not represent all of the students in the class level of confidence or level of comprehension. So some of the things we were talking about earlier, cold calling can be better. Random sampling can be better, although maybe less efficient, because you're not getting it. Again, you're not getting a read on every kid in the class simultaneously. So you might have to ask a few more. So yeah, taking hands, you know, raised hands, nah, not the best. Cold calling slightly better with caveat and with fine points of how to tune that a little bit better. But he describes that the most valid, the most efficient way of checking for student understanding is whole class questioning. This increases the ratio. If everyone has to answer, they'd have to be doing some thinking and be thinking about the topic at hand. So some of the ways that he lays out in this mini article are just multiple choice questions. Students can answer with their fingers, 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5, 1, 2, 3, or 4, you know, A, B, C, whatever it is. If everyone answers, then you could look around and get a quick check, and then you know everybody's answer, everybody's level of understanding. He proposes using mini whiteboards, which we can talk and get Girl Boss about how we might use those, what sorts of questions that we might actually ask for students to respond with whiteboards. And he doesn't list choral responses on there, but that is such a natural segue for us in comprehension-based teaching world, is choral responses are a helpful technique, because just based on this, how the class responds chorally, you can kind of get a feel for, oh, students are understanding quite a lot if they're responding quickly and with strength, versus if they're kind of giving a tepid half response, that might indicate that you need to reteach, to reestablish meaning, whatever it is. What he describes as most important in this is sharp execution. If students are giving a response, they should all give it at the same time so that they don't have time to look around and kind of see how other people are answering, and they should all be answering at the same time, so that way you can see that they are prepared to respond in general. And that is, again, a check on how well they're understanding. So that was the article. It's like a very quick read. All the evidence snacks are very quick reads. I recommend them to you, and they're linked in the show notes if you would like to subscribe, like I am, and just get some general education tips, tricks, thoughts that can be very helpful.
I just subscribed while you were talking.
I'm going to now ask Bill to repeat the last three things I said as a show of his understanding. Just kidding.
All right, and now just to move into girl bossing, I do have an aside on how we've girl bossed. This past weekend, it was Actful. Sorry, it'll be 2 weekends ago when you hear this, but it was great. It was a great time. I think it might have been my most enjoyable Actful yet, and in part because I saw this wonderful presentation by our very own Brian on student perception of standard-based grading. It was really, really good. We were trying to bully him into ditching the plans this week and talking about the thesis, but Brian didn't want to yet, so it's fine. We still love
it. I appreciate your positive feedback, and
it was really great. I don't think you were grasping how great it was. You slayed. And of course. And other than that, it was just a really fun weekend. Brian and I slayed just hanging out together in Philadelphia and cried
I stayed at home.
Well, there were only two wives present of the sleigh, so next time we must coordinate to maximize our joint sleigh.
So maybe New Orleans next year. But it was a really fun conference. But
yeah,
on how Girl Boss checking for understanding, I think one of the ways that I've enjoyed, especially like getting all student responses, is Nearpod or Pear Deck. So if you're unfamiliar, these tools allow you to take a slide presentation and make it interactive. It's a lot of fun. And I say it's a lot of fun. It's valuable feedback for me as the teacher. Some of my students have overdone Pear Deck and Nearpod, so they don't like it when we use it, but it's really valuable. So students all on their own devices answer questions in a variety of different ways, and you get responses from everyone. So, and it shows you as people are responding. So if I see, oh, I need like two more responses before we can move on. But yeah, I really like that. I also have an A, B, C, and D poster, and those are always in the four corners of my room. I also, so I can do multiple choice and get students moving. You'll get students that are watching where everyone else is going. So I do try to make questions like that more opinion than just correct or incorrect. And I have also just made some half sheets that on one side it says A and B, on the other side it says C and D. So students just flip the card and orient it so that their answer is on the upside, so I can see what they say.
Have either of you used Plickers? Or have you heard of Plickers?
I've heard of it, and I don't understand it.
So it's like, okay, I think there is a more low-tech version that I would prefer to use, but basically you have a card with like a QR code, right? And it's like based on how you hold the card up, if you take a phone and you just kind of scan over the audience, your class, all of their answers, it will generate some data on their website. So you can see numerically how many students answered A, B, C, or D. And it's really versatile because you can have any question, like you don't have to make the questions in advance, like you might need to do on Nearpod or Pear Deck. Although I guess you could also just put A, B, C, D, like you don't necessarily need to have a question. But anyway, I've seen a teacher use it and it looked really cool. And then I was like, I'm going to use this, and I just never did. But I think if you had like a card that just had A, B, C, and D written on each side, like of the square, and they just, you know, whatever is up is the correct answer, like you could do that and just visually scan. But if you, you know, you want some more data, numerical data that you can refer to or in the spreadsheet or something like that, that's something you could consider.
I love that
because everyone's responding.
And I like it that it is teacher tech, but not student tech. But I also then feel uncomfortable pointing my phone at.
Yeah, that's the part I just can't really.
Like if that would, I feel like that would take me out of the moment of class, because I'll be like, oh, because I'm gonna like I'll fumble with my phone, and then I'll look like a silly goofball, and then the kids will make fun of me even more.
But let's pick low technology checks for understanding. You could do that with note cards.
Yeah, but I do like the data collection. That is
good helpful. Yeah, I think that the choral responses are kind of like the go-to for many people in the comprehension-based communicative language teaching world. The trick is that sharp execution that Peps McCray talks about in the article, which is getting everyone to respond at exactly the same time. I hold up three fingers if I want a choral response as a way of indicating that you get 3 seconds to think. This gives kids think time to process and prepare themselves to answer, and also stops. And so, you know, I pull up the three fingers, I say the question, then I go 1, 2, 3, and then, indicate to them that they answer. So think time plus quiz. And from that, you get information. If you're looking around, maybe you have students in mind that you think, you know, you really want to check their understanding, see how or if they respond. But you also get a whole class feel. For the strength of the response sometimes tells you the information you need that, oh, the class is really getting this because they responded so quickly and like right on top of it, or they responded kind of lethargically, and that either indicates that they're having a moment of laziness, as we all do, or that they're not getting it and you need to go back and re-explain it. And so that is a more informed decision that you made via your check for understanding that everyone had to do.
A branch off of that, I love the different like hand signals for different types of questions. And you cut out a little bit on my end, but Brian looked like he was agreeing with you. So I'm hoping he heard you and it's not out. But so you do the three fingers for counting down. So like everyone responds. Did something that I do is, again, you might have mentioned this. So I'll raise my hand if I want want volunteers, or when I ask a question, or I'll say classe before if I want everyone to just answer. So
I think prompting students how you want them to respond is a behavior management really thing, but it also helps us with the think time and things like that. So yeah, whole class response, I give 3 seconds, raised hand if I want a raised hand. I just give a like waving towards myself if I want everyone just to shout out answers and stuff like that. That again is like, is partially management, but it also helps with the ratio of student thinking.
And then my branch off that is sometimes I'll throw out a challenge question. So I'll just like note like, ooh, like I'll come up with a question that would require like a complex structure of an answer. And I've got students that like really respond to when I say like, okay, challenge question. And they also learn the word for challenge because that's like a useful word. They pick up, and then I always remind them as well, like, remember, this is a challenge question. Like, this is a question that you're going to have to like push your language to be able to answer. And that would be true for anyone who's trying to answer the question. So please feel free to try, and we're here to support you.
Have we mentioned the mini whiteboards? I'm not sure. I mean, if you want something besides,
how do you use them?
Yes, no, A, B, C, D, like an actual word or sentence as a response, you could use a mini whiteboard. There are many options for getting them. You could either buy a set, or if you have like, I don't know, people have gotten like a big like slab kind of like markerable paper. I don't even know what to call it, but like then you cut it up and then you can distribute those, or you could even just use sheet protectors and white paper. I know there's lots of different ways teachers have gone about using those, and they're good because when I use them, I always, you know, first of all, it takes a while to write out a full sentence or, you know, word, or like there's just think time naturally involved in it. And I always say like, you can't raise your board up until I count down till, you know, from 5 or something like that. And so that way, like everyone raises it up at the same time and I can see like just in that moment, like who gets it, who doesn't. And it's very efficient. But I guess the thing about whiteboards that I don't love is the marker situation and erasing situation. Short of like just buying like a full set of markers and erasers for the whole class, like every other kind of bring a sock, use a tissue, like things like that, like they always just get kind of gross, or like students lose them. And so sometimes just because I want things to not look gross, like I kind of avoid it. But I don't know, this conversation is kind of getting me to think about ways I can bring it back. Any success stories from that?
I did find like a $10 box of 48 erasers. So online.
I bought a bunch of mini erasers, and those come out as the supplies for whiteboard activities.
Couple things on that, because the kids love whiteboards. They also love to doodle when they should be doing other things. So something that I do when we pull out the whiteboards to do something, I have them, I forget who I learned this from, but like, I love it. I tell them to put the whiteboard on their head and with the marker to draw something, so they can get their doodles out before. So I'd say like, draw a cat. And then we all compare who's is the best or looks most like a cat. And then also with not many whiteboards, but with like my bell work that I do, I try to incorporate something that students can go up to the board to write. So maybe we just did food. We're working on like food stuff, Spanish 4. So to check their vocabulary ahead of time, I had my Pictionary that I've talked about before. And then I just projected that without the words to see what they could name to start off. And there's like 25 of the words on a page. So I just say, make sure that everyone gets a chance to write one before you write another one. And it gets up and moving, and typically a fun way to start class. But it also might be just like finish the sentence, go up and write what you wrote to finish the sentence.
I have one more consideration for Check for Understanding specific to language classrooms. I've been reading Common Ground by Henshawn Hawkins continuously over the course of the year, so I reference it all the time. And they're kind of in their way of trying to avoid English as a check for understanding in classes, because I was taught early on, just ask, what did I just say? And then have the students say it in English. If you want to avoid that, to try to stay even more in the target language, their kind of number one guiding principle is creating activities with clear outcomes or purposes that compel students to understand, so that they can't complete the activity unless they showed understanding. And having those activities be smaller, right? So that, you know, they're compelled to make a choice or to indicate an opinion or a thought or an answer much more frequently than, you know, some sort of long activity where they get to the end and then just can't do it. And they kind of talk in the book, I've just been reading the chapter about input, and they talk about how to use them. It's okay to, you know, ask this or that questions. It's okay to ask yes or no questions, kind of classic circling questions, but that it might tell students to tune out after a while and stop processing the language for meaning if they know you're only going to ask questions that don't have a purpose other than to display information you already know. And so you have to mix in personalized questions with that. But even then, there's a pitfall with personalized questions that you could ask a personalized question and a student could just give an answer of a word that they heard most recently. So you have to ask even more follow-up questions about that personalized question in order to really see that the student was understanding, but also engage in communication with the student that provides input to them as well as the class. So that's an additional consideration for our language class friendos.
Anything else to Girl Boss this week? It doesn't look like it. So thank you all for a great semester. I can't believe that. I don't even know how many episodes this is. Is this 10?
This is our 10th episode.
This is our 10th episode. Yeah. And that's crazy. That is wild. But we are going to take a break. So we will be off for the month of December, which probably for the best. That's typically a hectic time with finals or whatever you do to end the semester. So we hope that everyone had an enjoyable end of the year and hope that you can find time to relax and recharge and catch up on your favorite slaying podcast, something. I don't know. We can't wait to come back next year. See you in 2025.
Bye.
Don't forget to play. Bye.